So creation astronomy basically means the laws of the stars. Why do we say the stars have laws? Astronomy was originally under the mathematical discipline. It was originally a mathematical science, and then later was brought out under its own into its own discipline later. But it was originally mathematical science. The physical processes that go on in the cosmos are predictable. It runs like clockwork. They can tell where things are going to be at later points in time because they can extrapolate their future positions mathematically. So this is an overview of creation astronomy. We'll get into Big Bang cosmology versus creation cosmology next month. First, we need to address our presuppositions, the presuppositions that we deal with in this world. Supernaturalism, whether you want to call them atheism versus theism, or evolution versus creation. You deal with them in astronomy as well as biological science or in geology. So these two worldviews, whichever you take, will affect the way you view your world. And in a recent survey taken in 1998 and published in the journal Nature, researchers found that in the National Academy of Sciences, the governing body of the scientific community founded by Abraham Lincoln Long, and now all members of the National Academy of Sciences are appointed by current members of the National Academy of Sciences. Within the National Academy of Science, 7.5% of the physicists and astronomers in the NAS believe in God. So when we get our information from the astronomical community, from the physicists, we have to remember that they are atheists, that what they are teaching us is an atheistic worldview, how they view your world from their presuppositions. These two worldviews will affect the way you see the world, they will affect the way you see your cosmos, and what we're being taught today, just as in biological sciences, what we're being taught from the astronomers is an atheistic worldview, an atheistic presupposition or ideology to explain the existence of the cosmos. What does the word cosmos mean, by the way? We use it interchangeably with universe, but what does that word mean? It's a Greek word, really meant everything. But today, they use it more to refer to the ordered universe. Cosmos versus chaos. Cosmos is the ordered universe. We realize that the universe is ordered. Cosmology then is generally studies the nature of the ordered universe, typically dealing with issues of origins. How did the cosmos come about? So we'll be looking at two models. The evolution model teaches a Big Bang origin of the universe, a universe that's between 12 and 15 billion years old. 13.7 is the age that they hold to now, 13.7 billion years old, and that the celestial bodies are formed by natural processes, whereas the biblical model teaches that God created the universe, that the universe is young, the same age as the earth, right? And that God created the celestial bodies. It says that God named the stars, named them. He knows their number. So do stars still form today, or did God create them? We'll look at star formation next month. A lot of people try to resolve the Big Bang cosmology with creation cosmology, but they cannot be reconciled. The timelines are different, clearly different. If you look at the days of creation versus Big Bang cosmology, they occur at different times, right? According to the evolution model, the stars existed before the earth. But according to the Genesis, what was created first? Earth. The earth and space were created on the first day of creation. When were the stars created? The fourth day. The stars, the sun, and the moon were all created on the fourth day, even after plants. So according to the creation timeline, stars were created much later than the earth, but according to Big Bang cosmology, they were one of the first things formed. The sun is the first light according to Big Bang cosmology, but there was light on earth before the sun, according to the Bible. What that light was, we really don't know. Was there light that just saturated the universe? Some people say that light was the light that came from God. I've heard others propose that plasma, which is where we get that, it basically just saturated the universe perhaps, and then God then sequestered it into the bodies that we refer to of as stars today. I don't think we'll ever know. We have to realize that much of what happened during that initial creation week, we will never understand. So, and then the rest of it there doesn't fall in line either when you're talking about evolution, but we're pretty much just looking at cosmology during this presentation. So here's my outline. We're going to cover this first half this month, and then next month we'll be looking at creation cosmology versus the Big Bang. So for this month, we'll start off with a section that I'll call the why, whens, and hows of cosmology. Why did God create the earth? When did he create it? How did he create it? Then we'll look at some evidence of design within the solar system. Then we'll look at several evidences for a young universe, a young galaxy. So when? Let's start with the whens. When did God create the cosmos? We've already established that to some extent, that God created lights on the fourth day of creation, but according to the biblical chronology, God created the universe about 6,000 years ago, right? He created the earth 6,000 years ago, he created the universe as well about 6,000 years ago. A lot of this comes from the biblical genealogy. The Bible states exactly when a person had his firstborn son, how old he was when he had his firstborn son, and then how old his son when he had his firstborn son. There's a biblical genealogy leading all the way from Adam, all the way through Noah, and then picks up again later. Noah was alive when Abraham was born. Did you know that? So there's a biblical genealogy that pretty much establishes that the earth was created right around 6,000 years ago, the flood occurring itself about 1656. So the universe was created about 6,000 years ago. So let's look at the sequence of events again real quickly. So on day one, as we established already, God created earth and space and light. Day two, created the atmosphere. Day three, dry land and plants. And it wasn't until day four that the sun, moon, and stars were created. So this timeline doesn't at all fit with the Big Bang cosmology. A lot of creationists try to reconcile the two. Those that are known as day-age creationists will attempt to say, Big Bang cosmology was just God's way of creating the cosmos. That each day of the creation was simply a vast period of time, maybe a billion years each. But this timeline just does not fit. Even if these days were each a billion years old, I mean, you're not going to have plants that are alive for a billion years before the sun is created, right? So there's some serious problems with it. But just the fact that the earth is created before the sun, the moon, and the stars causes serious problems with regard to day-age creationism, or what you call progressive creationism, just another form of theistic evolution. So what is the purpose of the cosmos? If the cosmos was the result of natural processes, then there should be some things out there that have no purpose. If God created the cosmos, then everything out there should have a purpose. That's the way we look at the world. That's the way I do, especially when studying biological sciences. There's nothing that a biological organism has that doesn't have a purpose. They try to name, if an organ doesn't have a known function, they say it's a vestigial organ. Usually that's just, they haven't figured out what it does yet. Later they figure out what it does, and then we shouldn't have been taking that out. You know what I'm saying? So everything should have a purpose. So let's look at some of the purposes of the cosmos. So, why did God create the cosmos? One reason is, as stated in Genesis 1:14, for signs to mark seasons. Genesis 1:14 says, "And God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the sky to separate the day from the night, and let them serve as signs to mark seasons and days and years." It's a big clock. One of the functions of the cosmos is to serve as a big timepiece to help us keep track of the times and the seasons. Just like the moon itself marks the passage of a month, the rotation of the day marks the rotation of the earth marks the passage of a day. The rotation of the moon around the earth marks the passage of a month. The rotation of the earth around the sun marks the passage of a year. You may already know all of this. We seem to be well-informed creationists. But so where did the week come from? We probably already know this, but the day, the month, and the year all come from astronomical processes, but where did the week come from? Is there an astronomical process that marks the end of a seven-day period? The week comes from the Bible, right? Yeah. specifically from Exodus 20:11. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven, the earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Who's talking right here? What's the context of this particular passage? Who's saying this? That's God. That is God speaking, writing the Ten Commandments down for Moses. This is part of the Ten Commandments. God made the Sabbath a holy day, ordained the week as our work week because he worked a week. So the week comes from the Bible, not from an astronomical process. But it's largely a big timepiece. Why else? We created it to give light, to give us light. What's the purpose of light? Obviously, we need it because we don't see in the dark very well, but he could have created us to see in the dark, perhaps. What are some of the purposes of light? Plants need them for photosynthesis. Plants create sugar using energy from the sun. Plants are the beginning of the food chain. Without them, life as we know it would not be possible. So we're relying upon the sun ultimately for the energy that allows us to move muscle and perform all the other biological processes that require chemical potential energy. So plants are making sugar using energy from the sun, carbon dioxide and water. It also gives us heat. This is an infrared photograph of the moon showing the heat that's emanating off the moon that's ultimately come from the sun. So we get infrared radiation from the sun that heats the earth. We also use light for navigation, right? Whether it's the sun, the moon, or the stars, they help us navigate our way around. You ever seen bugs flying around a lamppost? Why does that happen? Anyone know? Why do bugs get hung up around a lamppost or around the light outside your doorway and stay there buzzing around, huh? Because they use light to navigate. They use the light of the moon to navigate, and they become fooled into thinking that your porch light or that street light is the moon. They're trying to head north or south or west based on wherever the moon is at that particular point in time, and they're getting off track. So we use stars to navigate. Stars like Polaris, which is otherwise known as the North Star, right? You can find the North Star by following these two stars at the end of the Big Dipper. Follow those directly up, you find Polaris. Polaris is always in the north. That's because it never moves. It's parallel to the axis of the earth, so it lies just above the earth. And as the earth spins, basically Polaris stays fixed, and all of the rest of the sky basically spins around Polaris from our point of view. So Polaris always stays north of our position. We used to navigate. Instruments have been used to read the stars and to navigate sent back as far as 200 BC. The astrolabe was used as far as 200 BC. The sextant developed in the 1700s, but still in use today. Even the U.S. military takes regular readings of the stars. They have the ship's quartermaster. Even like your big aircraft carriers, they'll send the ship's quartermaster out with a sextant to read the stars and compare that against the GPS data to confirm their actual position. So we use them for navigation. The constellations were a way of mapping the sky. Also a navigational tool. You get familiar with the sky. You know where you are at any one particular time. Now, the constellations have been somewhat taken over by the pagan religion of astrology. But nonetheless, it's just a way of mapping the sky. And we really don't know how far back the naming of the constellations go. They go back beyond written history. So we really don't know exactly when many of these were named. But they're still in use today, even by modern astronomers. Ursa, Ursidae, or Ursus are the names of the genus and the family that bears belong to. Ursa Major is the bear. And these were all named after either animals or the names of people in stories. Okay, but constellations are just a grouping of stars that possess a crude shape, and they would match that shape up to some figure as a way of helping them remember where they were in relation to the night sky at any particular point in time. Taurus the Bull, Orion. Astronomers still use the constellations today to mark where events are happening in the sky, where a supernova happens or wherever a particular a nebula lies. We still use those constellations. For example, the Orion Nebula falls within the Orion constellation, right? There was a supernova that happened in Orion, and now the Orion Nebula exists there today. So why do we have planets? We know why the Earth exists. Well, what's the purpose of the rest of the planets in our solar system? Why are they there? We know why the sun's there. The moon, we do know why the moon's there also, but why the rest of the planets there? I mean, there must be a purpose, right? Must be a purpose for the planets. So at least one is that stabilizes the distance of the Earth to the sun, keeps the Earth from moving too closely to the sun, keeps it from moving too further away from the sun. So these other planets help stabilize our orbit. Another purpose of the planets is they to some extent, may protect the Earth from asteroids or meteorites. Now, this begs another question. Were asteroids and meteorites, why would they create asteroids and meteorites if they were a hazard to the Earth? Why would they be there in the first place? But there are indeed a lot of asteroids and meteorites that the Earth needs to be protected from. This is a NASA animation showing the number of asteroids approaching Earth over a two-month period in 2002. So that's the Earth right there, and these are the number of asteroids in our vicinity during a two-month period of time. Now, this spans quite a distance of space. So this is a 20 million kilometer span right in here. So it's quite a great distance. But nonetheless, there are a lot of asteroids out there, and the planets might be protecting us from those asteroids. But why are there asteroids there in the beginning? Kind of begs another question. There's an asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter, a dense asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. Let me get back to my final question. I thought I had another graphic here showing most of the planets and moons in our solar system have differential impact craters. They have impact craters in one hemisphere, but not in another. It would seem to indicate that over a short period of time, they were pelted with asteroids. There's a dense asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter, and it has been proposed, at least, that a planet used to exist there, which exploded or broke apart. We know that the creation was cursed, that at the time of Adam and Eve's sin, that the creation was cursed, and we know this just didn't affect Adam and Eve, but it affected the whole of creation, not just the Earth itself, but the cosmos also. So we have to wonder, what effects did the cosmos suffer as a result of the curse? Did supernovas, did stars always go supernova? Was that part of the original creation, or is it part of the curse? Did Saturn's rings are also thought to be the result of a moon that existed in Saturn's orbit that then broke apart, and the rings are now the dust and debris from an ancient moon. So what caused that moon to explode? Was there indeed a planet between Mars and Jupiter? It has been at least proposed that the source of the flood itself was a meteorite bombardment, or a bombardment of asteroids that broke the Earth into the plates that it now exists as today, causing the Earth to become flooded, release the subterranean waters and the volcanic gases that caused it to start raining. So, at least it. So, whether or not the planets are there to protect from asteroids or not, you would have to guess whether or not asteroids were a part of the original creation in the first place. So, nonetheless, I try to look at for a purpose in everything, but clearly, the Bible says that the heavens were there to declare the glory and righteousness of God. Psalms 19:1, the heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Psalms 56, and the heavens proclaim his righteousness. The heavens are the only part of the creation that are stated to proclaim the glory of God. And they do indeed. The heavens are a glorious place. Anyone that studies them believes that at least the scientists of old that studied astronomy believed that they were studying the handiwork of God. How can we not see the beauty and the marvel that's within this system? When we see the galaxies, things that were once just a pinpoint of light to us, we thought maybe just a star. We focus in on them later and realize it's a galaxy made up of billions of stars, 100 billion stars. is the average number that exists and thought to exist in most galaxies. And there are about thought to be 100 billion galaxies, at least within the expanse of space that we can see now with modern telescopes. Beautiful galaxies. Whirlpool galaxies. This is called the Sombrero Galaxy. Whirlpool Galaxy. I think this is M51. Dust and debris. Some galaxies are facing us, whereas on others, we're looking at them from the side. So this is one that's facing us directly. And even now when we aim the Hubble Space Telescope to an area of space that looks like it's empty, leave it there for a few days, 10 days, and they're able to view many more galaxies. These deep-field photos have shown us that space is indeed much more vast than we thought it was and much more complex, that galaxies exist in the edge of space where they originally thought nothing would be. Based on Big Bang cosmology, there should really be no galaxies of that nature there. So we'll get into that next month. Stars go supernova. There's a star right there going supernova. Supernova is basically an explosion. A star has just all of a sudden decided to give up the ghost and explode. When stars explode, they produce nebula like this. This is the Crab Nebula in the Crab constellation. Went supernova in the year 1054. We know where it went, when it went supernova, and we know where it is today. These nebulas expand rapidly. This is called the Eagle Nebula, the famous Eagle Nebula. Many of these nebulas are named after the constellation. Others are named after their shape, that they have a specific kind of shape, the Rosette Nebula. I think nebulas are one of my favorite astronomical objects. There's just a lot of beauty there. Okay, so how did God create the cosmos? I'm not sure we'll ever thoroughly be able to answer this question, but what does the Bible say? How did God create the cosmos? He spoke the universe into existence, right? Genesis 1:3, and God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. He just spoke it into existence. Psalms 33:6, by the word of the Lord were the heavens made, their starry host by the breath of his mouth. He spoke the universe into existence. God's word exists in three forms. There's the written word, the Bible. There's the living word, his son. And there's the spoken word, his creation. So you can get to know God by getting to know any of the three words of God that were left to us. By studying the creation, you can get to know the handiwork of God. And indeed, many of your scientists of old thought that they were getting to know the handiwork of God by studying astronomy and mathematics. They thought they were getting to know God. Also says that God stretched out the heavens. Many, many verses in the Bible that speak of God stretching out the heavens. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Zechariah, 17 verses in total speak of God stretching out the heavens. Isaiah 42:5, he who created the heavens and stretched them out, who spread them out, and all that comes out of it, who gives breath to people. Who alone stretched out the heavens? My own hands stretched out the heavens. 17 verses in the Bible total talks about God stretching out the heavens. Does this mean that the Big Bang is true? The Big Bang, we'll get into what the Big Bang is, but the Big Bang is basically an expansion of space. It talks about the universe rapidly expanding to its present form today. Can we reconcile these scriptures talking about God stretching out the heavens with the Big Bang? No, I don't think so. If the Big Bang is true, then what we've had is 2,000 years of incorrect interpretation of the Bible. Science is needed to properly understand the Bible, and therefore the authority of the scriptures in doubt. And the earth itself is not a special place. Big Bang cosmology teaches that the earth is not a special place, that we're not at the center of the universe, that we're in no special place at all. We're just one planet in one solar system and in a minor galaxy that's in another, it's itself a cluster of galaxies, that the earth is not a special place. We have to remember, though, when we start talking about cosmology, we may never truly understand how God created the universe. We just have to remember that God is a God of miracles. God created the universe mature for us. The universe is indeed young. We will get into Big Bang cosmology and some issues related to speed of light next month, but we have to remember that God is a God of miracles, and We can't really confine him to physical laws. So not necessarily are we able to explain away how this distant starlight reached the Earth. So just touch briefly on intelligent design. This most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent being. When I look at the solar system, I see the Earth at the right distance from the sun to receive the proper amounts of heat and light. This did not happen by chance. Clearly, the statements of someone who believes in that an intelligent being designed the cosmos, that it's the result of intelligent design. These were stated by Sir Isaac Newton, perhaps one of the most brilliant men that has lived to date. So is the Earth a special place? Of course, big bang cosmology would say no. But in the 1990s, there was a resurgence of not only intelligent design has become quite popular, but the anthropic principle. Both the intelligent design community seems to a large extent use the anthropic principle, which basically was an attempt to explain some of the more mysterious aspects of the cosmos, basically stating that the universe possesses all of these things so that someone could see them, that there would be no purpose to them if there wasn't an intelligent being there to see them and how magnificent they are. That's basically what the anthropic principle teaches. Big Bang cosmology teaches that the solar system formed through what they call, the current explanation is what they call nebular hypothesis. A nebula is a cloud of gas and dust. When that cloud of gas and dust is exposed to regional movements within the cosmos, that cloud of gas and dust can swirl and spiral. And when that happens, condensation of particulates can happen, accretion of planets and stars can form, and that's how they believe that our solar system formed, through what they call the nebular hypothesis. But if this was indeed the case, then basically everything in our solar system should be similar. The planets should be very, very similar. They should be following similar paths. They should have similar rotations. They should all conform to a single pattern. But of the 9 planets that are in our solar system, only the Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, and Neptune rotate in a way that we would consider normal. Mercury and Venus rotate too slowly in comparison to the rates of the other planets. This is Mercury. Venus, seen here, Uranus and Pluto also has a rotation that's opposite to the other planets, called retrograde. The others rotate counterclockwise as they orbit around the sun. But Venus, Uranus, and Pluto rotate clockwise as they go around the sun, opposite the other planets. But if the solar system formed through natural processes, through this nebular hypothesis type explanation, then these rotations should all be going in the same direction. It's inexplicable. Uranus, pictured here, and Pluto are tilted. Their axes are greatly tilted in comparison to the rest of the planets. Most of them are tilted almost to the exact same amount, but we have a couple that are tilted differently. Uranus is also ringed. This looks like it was a doctored photo, but it's not. This has come from. All of the photos that I've placed in this are NASA photos. They're all public domain. I try to construct these PowerPoint presentations so I can upload them to the web. So all the graphics within it are public domain. I'll upload this to the web when I'm finished with it, and people can download it and use it. So is our world a privileged planet then? Is it special in the galaxy? What is it about our planet that tells us that it's very unique? Well, our moon is just the right size and distance from the Earth. If it was any closer or any further away, our moon's galaxy stabilizes the Earth. Our moon's gravity, stabilizes the Earth's rotation. Our position in our galaxy is just right so that we can actually see the cosmos. Our sun is just the precise mass and composition to serve its purpose. Our atmosphere is clear, allowing investigation of the cosmos. There's a documentary that covers many aspects of our cosmos that would indicate strongly that it's the result of intelligent design, called The Privileged Planet. Basically, the It's based on a book of the same title written by Guillermo Gonzalez. And basically, the proposal is two-part. Not only is our world created by an intelligent designer, but it was created in a way that would allow us to investigate the nature of the cosmos. So what they're proposing this in this documentary is two parts. I didn't think this through well enough. Set up this way, we're not going to be able to hear this clip. Okay. But what the documentary goes into in a little more detail, it illustrates several aspects of our existence that must be there in order for life as we know it to exist. And then it assigns each of these aspects a 1/10 probability. So it's 1/10 probability that that would exist as a result of the Big Bang cosmology, a very, very conservative figure. But when added up, all of these probabilities equal to a final probability that is just absolutely impossible. So it talks about the terrestrial planets, plate tectonics, the magnetic field, how the Earth has just the right temperature to sustain a magnetic field and protect us from cosmic bombardment, that has an oxygen-rich atmosphere, liquid water. All of these things must be there for life as we know it to exist. If taken individually, these are not significant. But when you add them up, when you add the probabilities of these individual elements together, you reach a statistical number that's astronomically impossible. So they've assigned basically a 1/10 value, a 1/10 probability to each of these factors they deem necessary for life as we know it to exist. And when they multiply all these together, they reach a number that's, it's like 1/10 of 1 trillion, a number that's astronomically impossible. Anyway, The Privileged Planet, a really excellent documentary that goes into the intelligent design that's inherent within the cosmos. I'd recommend it. Okay, so let's change gears and look at some evidence for a young age. This is by no means an exhaustive list. I'm just touching on a few of the most common examples for a young age of the cosmos. We'll look at the recession of the moon. We'll look at comets, the existence of comets within the solar system. We'll look at the age of the sun. What does the sun tell us about its age and how long should it last? And something called supernova remnants. And like I said, what we have to remember is that astronomers today, much like biologists and geologists, are themselves evolutionists. They are at the root atheists, and they are teaching us an ideology to explain our existence without God. And so we have to remember that much of what we're being taught in schools is the evidence that supports their view, and they're leaving a lot out. Okay, so we'll start with the moon. The Earth's gravity pulls on the moon, and the moon's gravity pulls on the Earth as well. Then what happens, tidal forces basically cause the moon to accelerate, and this acceleration causes the moon to speed up and gradually pull away from the Earth. So the moon is basically pulling away from the Earth at a rate of 4 centimeters per year. Doesn't seem like much. The moon is itself, I think it's 280,000 miles away, something close to that. I'd have to look at my figures again. But four centimeters a year doesn't sound like a lot when you consider how far away the moon is. But if we take these values and extrapolate them back into time. Remember, the solar system itself is supposed to be 4.6 billion years old. The Earth is 4.6 billion years old. Basically, everything in the solar system formed at the same point in time. It's all thought to be about the same age. About 1,000 years ago, the moon would have been 125 feet closer at this 4-centimeter rate. A million years ago, it would have been 28.4 miles closer. At 10 million years ago, it would have been 284 miles closer. At 100 million years ago, it would have been 2,840 miles closer. 1 billion years ago, 28,400 miles closer, and at 1.4 billion years ago, it would have been in contact at its present rate of acceleration, at recession. Now, it's thought that that its recession would have been linear up to about 1,000 years ago, but nonetheless, the data seems pretty clear that at about 1.4 billion years ago, the moon would have been in contact with the Earth at its present rate of recession. Now, this is in itself not evidence that the world, that the Earth itself is 6,000 years old, but gives us an upper limit to the age of the Earth that states that it's nowhere near the 4.6 billion years that the evolutionists claim that it is. So do we know where the moon came from in the first place? We don't. There are actually two theories related to the origin of the moon. One states that the moon was itself an asteroidal type body, a body that was elsewhere in the galaxy, and then happened to get caught in the Earth's gravitational field. Another theory states that the Earth was struck by an asteroid at a kind of a glancing blow that caused that chunk of the Earth to kick loose and then become a moon. But when they actually, and this was the most prominent theory held for some time until they actually were able to get samples from the moon, and then they determined that the moon is made of vastly different stuff than the Earth. But we at this point still do not know how the moon formed. It's really large in comparison to the other moons in the galaxy. The Earth's moon in relation to the size of the Earth is very, very large. It's about it's like 1/4 of the radius of its radius is about 1/4 of that of the Earth. So the origin of the moon is still unresolved. The best indication that we have now, though, that we're created along with the Earth about 6,000 years ago. So we don't know where the moon came from at this point. So comets. Comets are themselves also evidence of a young solar system. There are two types of comets that we find in our solar system. Those that are called short-period comets and those that are called long-period comets. Short-period comets are those that come back around about every 200 years or less. Long-period comets are those that come back around every 200 years or longer. So those are the two different kinds of comets that we have. The only comets that are have been observed, Halley's Comet was a short-period comet. It comes back around about every 76 years. That's been altered a little bit to every 75 to 76 years. But nonetheless, Halley's Comet was a short period comet. The Hale-Bopp Comet, remember the Hale-Bopp Comet came around about 1997. Whether it's a short period or long period, they don't really know, right? Because that's the first time they've ever seen it. So just when the last time it was that it came around, they don't know. But it was about 1,000 times brighter than Halley's Comet. But so what's the problem with comets? What are comets and how they differ from asteroids or, say, meteorites? Asteroids and meteorites are both rocks, whereas asteroids are made largely of ice. The tail of the asteroid itself is the part of the asteroid that's burning off. As it approaches the sun, it starts burning away. So the tail of the comet is parts of the comet that are basically falling off. And so a comet has a very short life. But if the solar system itself is billions of years old, then we shouldn't see comets still flying around the atmosphere. This is a big mystery. Why are there comets in our solar system if the solar system itself is 4.6 billion years old, when comets themselves will burn up in about 10,000 years or less? That's thought to be the upper limit of the age of a comet is about 10,000 years. And yet we have comets still flying around the solar system. The solar system thought to be 4.6 billion years old. So we have a dilemma. They have attempted to solve this dilemma by proposing that there is a big comet nursery out there floating around. Actually, two. There's one they call the Oort cloud and one they call the Kuiper belt. Now, the Kuiper belt has been somewhat substantiated, but the Oort cloud itself is still totally theoretic. Now, this may be a little bit difficult to see, but what you have here is this is the inner solar system, and then they stretch back to show you the outer solar system, and then they stretch back a little more, and then they stretch back a little more, so you see what's going on here. So this is the inner solar system, and this is the asteroid belt that I was telling you about that's between Mars and Jupiter, okay? Then here is the Kuiper belt. It doesn't spelling, doesn't it? But it's pronunciated Kuiper Belt, just outside of the orbit of Neptune, right there. Now they pull back a little further. Oh, and this is Sedna. Remember the moon that they just recently discovered? It's supposed to be about half the size of, another little planetoid, about half the size of Earth, that has a, it's hard to see its orbit, but the orbit of Sedna is right there in comparison to the rest of the solar system. So it's got a really long orbit. Nonetheless, there's the orbit of Sedna right there, and the theoretical location of the Oort cloud, where these comets are thought to originate. So we still have comets flying around our solar system, but they will burn up within 10,000 years because they're just, every time they pass back around the sun, they burn up a little further. That's where the tail is burning up. So they think that there's just a whole bunch of comets out there somewhere. We can't see them, but they must be out there because the solar system is 4.6 billion years old and these comets don't last but about 10,000 years. So there must be comets out there that periodically come, fall out of this Oort cloud and they come swinging around through the solar system. So again, here's the orbit of Jupiter. There's Neptune, and here's the Kuiper Belt, again, right here. Here's that asteroid belt in there between Mars and Jupiter. And here's a comet coming flying out of the Oort cloud, now coming and entering into our solar system. Basically comes and hits the sun and kind of slingshots back out into the solar system and then comes back around again, you know, every 76 years or whatever. So they have a theoretic explanation for the existence of this Oort cloud that is thought to continuously supply our solar system with asteroids that have a very short life. So, many scientists, this is a quote, many scientific papers are written each year about the Oort cloud, its properties, its origin, its evolution, yet there is not a shred of direct observational evidence for its existence. Who said this? Carl Sagan. Carl Sagan, a very affirmed evolutionist. There's not a shred of direct observational evidence. Timothy Ferris says, though the Oort cloud has yet to be observed, the theory accounts so well for the distribution of comets, comets' orbits, that most astronomers today accept its existence. What do you call that? That's what you call faith. That's a definition of faith right there. An unquestioning belief that does not require proof or observations. They have faith in things. It's just, wish they had faith in God. So Danny Faulkner, though, says, since it cannot be detected, the Oort cloud is not a scientific concept. This is not bad science, but non-science, masquerading as science. The existence of comets is good evidence that the solar system is only a few thousand years old. Don DeYoung. The existence of the Kuiper Belt and the Oort cloud of comets has not been verified. Perhaps there is an alternative. The presence of comets may be evidence that the solar system is not as old as it is assumed. However, in fairness, since 2002, they have found the existence of about 600 what they call Kuiper Belt objects. Now, whether these Kuiper Belt objects are actually comets, we don't know. They call them Kuiper Belt objects. They haven't yet been classified whether they're actually asteroids, but they're too large to be comets, at least the kind of comets we have observed. Kuiper Belt objects that they've found so far range in size from 100 to 500 kilometers, whereas the standard comet's much smaller, 10 kilometers. Hale-Bopp was only about 40 kilometers, and it was the largest comet in recorded history anyway. I mean, a comet of this size would be a spectacular sight, and none are on record as ever having been observed. So whether the Kuiper Belt objects ever become a source of long-period comets, and I should point that out. So the Oort cloud is thought to be the source of short-period comets. The Kuiper Belt thought to be the source of long-period comets. But whether either are a source of these comets, we don't know. But it, nonetheless, the existence of comets themselves and the short lifespan that they have is to some extent evidence, again, that the solar system is probably no more than 10,000 years old. So let's look at the sun. What about the sun? We have this seemingly perpetual source of energy, but can anything be a truly perpetual source of energy? Doesn't seem, they know it's not. They know the sun will eventually burn out. But here's the problem. The energy from the sun comes through what they call thermonuclear fusion. What's nuclear fusion? What's the difference between nuclear fusion and nuclear fission? So nuclear fusion is when two nuclei fuse together. Nuclear fission is when a nucleus splits into smaller nuclei. So the sun's nuclear fusion is thought to be driven by hydrogen atoms that are fusing to form helium, and then that helium basically radiates out along with the light. So we know that sun's light actually contains helium, something which we actually discovered during a perfect solar eclipse. And this is one of the things that is pointed out in the documentary Privileged Planet. One of its contentions is that our world seemed to be designed so we could discover it. And one of the things that they point out is that some of the discoveries we made about the sun and what it's made of came about during a perfect solar eclipse. We're one of the it's a truly perfect solar eclipse. The sun is 400 times larger than the moon, but it's also exactly 400 times further away. So we end up with these perfect solar eclipses. And it was during one of these solar eclipses that they were able to analyze the sun's light and see these absorption lines that told us that within the sun's light existed helium, and thereby sparked the theories that the sun was generating energy through thermonuclear fusion, producing helium. But nonetheless, this is the problem. Energy comes about through thermonuclear fusion. What happens during thermonuclear fusion is that a star like this should grow brighter with age. So it should continuously grow brighter. And if the sun is 4.6 billion years old, it should have brightened by about 40%. So what impact would this have on Earth's history? And how long has life thought to have been on Earth? Life itself is thought to have been on Earth several billion years. Okay? So the average temperature on Earth right now is between 59 and is right around 59 degrees, or what is equivalent to 15 degrees Celsius. Now, this is over the history of the Earth, including Ice Age, which we think happened at the time of the flood. There was an Ice Age, but the average temperature on Earth over its entire history is thought to be about 59 degrees or 15 degrees Celsius. A 25% increase in brightness would mean an increase in the average temperature up to bring the average temperature down to about 32 degrees or 18 degrees Celsius. So what does this mean? Basically, if the Earth was as old as they say it was, that the average temperature would have been down around 27 degrees Fahrenheit, which is equivalent to minus 278 degrees C or below freezing. So if the sun is as old, the sun and the Earth are both as old as they say they are, and if life has been on Earth as long as they claim that it has, and then based on these calculations, it's seemingly impossible. Okay? So let's look at one more. Supernova remnants. So what is a supernova remnant? When an Earth goes supernova, it leaves behind a cloud of gas and dust that we call a nebula. This is, again, the Crab Nebula, found within the Crab constellation, again, a supernova, the remnants of a supernova that happened about the year 1054. Well, supernova remnants go through three stages. The first stage lasts about 300 years. The second stage lasts 120,000 years, and the final stage lasts between 1 and 6 million years. Okay, these are ages that I got directly off of, or confirmed directly with the from a NASA website. Now, and these were published essentially. This is data that was essentially published by Jonathan Sarfati. Okay, so if the universe is truly billions of years old, now let's see, where do these values come from? Okay. What they think is, they estimate that within our galaxy, a supernova should occur about every 25 years. So that's the estimate. And we should be seeing a supernova about every 25 years. But we should only be able to see about 19% of them. So over a 300-year period, if there's a supernova happening every 25 years, that's 300 divided by 25 is 12. So... But we should only be able to see about 19% of them. That's what we think, based on how well we can see our galaxy. So that brings us down to about 2. So that's where these figures come from. Second stage supernova remnants supposed to last about 120,000 years. Therefore, based on the size of our galaxy, and again, these are values from within our galaxy, we should be seeing about 2,200 of those. And third stage, if the universe or the galaxy as well is about 4.6 billion years old, we should be seeing about 5,000. So, however, if the solar system, or rather our galaxy, is very young, 7,000 years or less, we should be, again, because this one only lasts 300 years, we should only be seeing two of those. And we should only be seeing 125 of these if the galaxy's 7,000 years old. And we shouldn't be seeing any at this stage, those that last 1 to 6 million years old. So what do we actually find? You may guess it. The actual number of stage one supernova remnants, only five have been observed. Stage two supernova remnants, only 200 have been observed, whereas we should see 10 times that many. And how many third stage supernova remnants do you think we've seen? You probably guessed, none. No third stage supernova remnants have been seen. So, there are many evidences for a young universe, for a young Earth. Jonathan Sarfati goes into many of these in his book, Refuting Compromise, which is basically an analysis of day age or progressive creationism. He gets a little bit technical at times, but it's a recommended read. He goes into the hermeneutics, the uses of the word day within the Genesis versus the rest of the Bible, and the exegetical, what the natural exegetical interpretation of the days of creation should be. The fact that it's days of creation reinforced with statements like there was evening and the morning. Exodus 20:11, where he ordained the creation week, where we get our work week from. The types of words that you use to indicate time. The Bible seems very specific about the age of the universe, about the age of the earth, and it seems to very plainly talk about the earth as being very, very young. That God created in 6 days, about 6,000 years ago. But today, cosmologists or astronomers would have us believe that the universe is itself about 13.7 billion years old. Now, there are many scientists currently working on creation cosmology. We have astronomers, we have physicists, astrophysicists, nuclear physicists. There are many creationist astronomers who do not believe that the universe is itself 13.7 billion years old, or our solar system itself 4.6 billion years old, but that both were created by the mighty hand of God and are themselves very, very young. Creation cosmology, however, is in its infancy. We do not know everything, but there are some excellent resources available. Danny Faulkner wrote this book recently, Universe by Design. It's a little bit technical, but it's a good read as well. So we can only give you an introduction in a situation like this. We can only kind of give you an introduction into creation astronomy. So I would encourage you at this point to check out some of these books. One of the ones I showed you earlier on in the presentation, Creation Astronomy, it's called the Astronomy Book, kind of a layman level book at Creation Astronomy. If you just want, it's suitable for high school students and up, but it's a layman level book called the Astronomy Book. If you want something a little more detailed, Universe by Design by Danny Faulkner is really good. Don DeYoung's book, Astronomy in the Bible, is also really good, suitable for a layperson. Then there are a number of other resources, videos. Starline Time by Russell Humphreys takes a look at how do we explain distant starlight in a young universe. So there are many resources available. The Privileged Planet, again, we don't carry that book in stock, but we do have that DVD. But there are many resources available on creation astronomy. All right. I know this hasn't been exhaustive coverage. Let me give you an idea again about what we're going to be covering next month, okay? This is where I took it. We went through the whys, whens, and hows of cosmology, looked at some evidence of intelligent design, anthropic principle, and then we looked at some evidence for a young solar system, young galaxy, with regard to supernova remnants. And so next month I want to take a look at creation cosmology versus Big Bang cosmology. What the difference is, what evidence can we incorporate into creation cosmology that the Big Bang cosmologists are teaching? How do we make sense of things like the formation of stars, the formation of galaxies? What about redshift? What does this imply? So those are some of the kinds of things we'll look at next week. All right. That's what I have. I'll take a few questions if you want. Thanks. Yeah, Rob.
Okay. Hale-Bopp comet, I believe, you know, it goes into orbit, and they're able to extrapolate from that orbit how large that orbit is now, when it came around before.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, didn't they figure out that it was between 4,300 and 4,400 years ago, which would have put it right smack dab in the middle of the days of Noah?
Yeah, I would be guessing about that. Is that what they said?
When it came around, that was on the news.
Just based on the size of its orbit, they thought the last time it came around would have been about 4,000 years ago?
Just an extrapolation from the, I guess, how they measure the ellipse itself or what part of it they can see.
I could have sworn that that was defined as a short-age comet, but I can't be certain about that. No, I may be thinking of Hale-Bopp. I meant Halley's Comet.
Halley's Comet's short term. Yeah.
Definitely a short age.
Hale-Bopp was between 4,300 and 4,400, they estimate.
Can anyone else confirm that? Yeah, I couldn't confirm that or not. Yeah, Jeff.
I thought at the beginning you said they say the Earth is 13.7 billion years old.
The universe, 13.7. Our solar system, 4.6.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, right. Of course, the Bible would say that they're both the same age, that the Earth, our solar system, the cosmos as a whole, were all created during that 6 days of creation week. Yeah, Bruce? No, I think it was just a conservative estimate. I think they state it should be 40, just kind of gave a conservative estimate and applied that to the known average temperatures to give a conservative estimate. But still, within the length of time that they say life has been on Earth, it would have been freezing. It would have been below 0 degrees Celsius, which is essentially the freezing temperature of water. Yeah, Ron.
I heard this very briefly. Donald Chittick, but he said something about 1992, the scientists figured out with the, not necessarily figured out exactly, but they came up with the fact that there was light prior to the creation of the sun. I think the secular scientists that figured this out.
Is that right?
Some experiment that was done in 1992. You know anything about it?
No, I haven't. Anyone else?
It stuck in my mind. I heard it several years ago.
I mentioned one of the reasons why I like teaching high school students is when you teach a lot, you tend to come up with new things. Now, I mentioned one of the arguments I taught in class. I teach a semester-long class on creation apologetics, and I mentioned the fact that the plants were created on day three, but the sun, the moon, and stars weren't created on day four, and how that puts a limit, plants just can't live but for a few days, certainly can't live even 1,000 years, much less 1 billion years, without sunlight. But, of course, one of the students right away pointed out the fact that, well, light was created on day one. And so that really then doesn't put a problem on it as much. Plants could therefore live. Maybe the light wasn't confined within a sun the way it is now, but light apparently existed at the time that the plants did, so.
Some variations of Big Bang Theory have light appearing after a certain number of years after the Big Bang, but before the creation of any galaxies.
Galaxies or stars or things? Any others? Any other comments? Go ahead. I didn't. What they said was that it should have been linear up until about a billion years ago. Why there was all of a sudden an exponential increase? I didn't look into that. It was too much.
There's a certain distance when they get close enough, they break apart or something.
Well, that's called the Roche limit, which
is. Yeah.
And that's
11,600.
Yeah, well, the gravity is indirectly to the tidal force. So yeah. The tidal force is creating a torque, it's causing the acceleration. Right now, that's why the moon is gravitationally standing still, because of the tidal torque. Of course, you sustain, you know, in a constant pace around it as it goes around. But the point is that if it was within the Roche limit, which is about 2 times the radius of the Earth, is the moon can't exist in a form. In other words, the tidal forces would break it apart for a period of time. So the theory that the moon formed by accretion is a very poor one, because if it accreted from small particles, it would never form into a moon in the first place. Well, like, for example, the only moons we know within the Roche limit are the moons of Mars, Dimorphos and Phobos. They're too small to have gravitational force. So they're the only moons in the solar system within the Roche limit. Now, the ones of Saturn, it's all fragments. They're little tiny ones. They're okay.
There are now two creation astronomy books on the moon itself. I haven't had time to get to those. I'm on my third book right now, just in the process of preparing for this particular presentation. Astronomy is a fascinating topic. I have a feeling I've started something.
Yeah, what do you think the likelihood of the dinosaurs getting killed by an asteroid? I know there's asteroids that have hit the Earth, but just relatively small and burned up in our atmosphere and so forth. But something that large, I'm sure, would have been found by now, and the likelihood, you know, I think they just cooked that story up.
Well, there is apparently evidence that the Earth has been struck by fairly significant asteroids at some point, or meteorites. There's a thin layer of iridium in the fossil record that is a mineral that's predominant in these celestial bodies, and there is to some extent some evidence for it, just how strong that really is. But a thin layer like that tends to indicate that it was struck at some point in time. Just think about it. Something caused the flood. Now, I myself am able to just accept the fact that it was the mighty finger of God that just came down and poked the earth. You know, he does tend to act at times within the physical laws. Would he have destroyed a planet out there between Mars and Jupiter and caused and allowed the debris from that to come down and rain upon earth in order to break the earth apart? The most common theory, it seems to be, that now the earth exists as all of these plates. It's like a hard-boiled egg that you've dropped down on the ground. So it's still intact, but it's now made up of all these broken outer pieces. And it's thought that before the flood that the earth was solid, and that something broke the earth into all of these plates, allowing the subterranean waters to spew forth and volcanic gas and these kind of things also. I mean, I'm willing to entertain the possibility that this was actually mentioned in the astronomy book. And I had thought about it for some time. I mean, the moon is covered with craters, right? All of the, you know, planets that we observe are just covered with craters. There is one moon, I can't remember, on that doesn't have any craters whatsoever. And I didn't...
Europa
doesn't have any craters whatsoever. What that means, I'm not really sure.
It has a few tiny ones,
but otherwise it's completely void of craters, whereas some of them are just covered. I mean, we see craters in craters. On, like at Mercury, there's shots of craters in craters. Some have been just completely pelted with asteroids, yet we see almost none today. Most of the big craters that we think are on Earth, they at some point changed their mind and said that they were volcanic calderas. Now they're starting to come back around and say that those are indeed meteor craters after all. Whether they are or not, I'm not sure they really know. But, of course, the dinosaurs themselves were killed during the global flood. Reintroduced along with all other animals, put brought on board the ark along with all other animals and reintroduced, and they had died out subsequently. Now, I don't really think that God would put some animal on board the ark just if he was going to die out from natural causes later. And so I tend to side with some of the creation theorists that propose that man was ultimately responsible for the demise of the dinosaurs after the flood, that the tales of dragon slayers and our actual recordings of when dinosaurs were being killed due to their threatening imposition. So I do tend to side with that. It seems we kill anything. Guys kill anything, you know. Girl sees a snake in your yard and they come and get you and tell you to go kill it. They don't want you to remove it. Don't just remove it and go throw it away in that field. They want it dead, you know. So when things have a threatening imposition, we kill them. That's just what we do. Yeah, and I guarantee you, if there was a dinosaur alive today, if all of a sudden one appeared somewhere, we'd go out and kill it right away. That's just what would happen. It seems reasonable. Bill, I... Because we have many animals alive today that are basically identical to the dinosaurs, you know. They may be much smaller, and so it seemed to be selectively kill off the ones that are big, you know, whatever it was. It's kind of, John.
The Shoemaker Levy was destroyed on Jupiter recently.
Right.
It seems like that should be a good argument for young Earth creation, because the fact in our recorded history, we've actually seen a comet destroyed. That was a very shocking.
That's another comment that actually impacted with Jupiter. How long ago was that?
10 years.
Mm-hmm.
12 years ago.
Yeah. All right. Any other questions, comments? Yes.
Isn't it true, though, that after the flood, that the weather patterns and that changed on the Earth? It might have made a difference in whether or not certain animals could...
It is thought that right after the flood, that's when the Ice Age occurred. That it was a result of all the volcanic gases going into the air and all the precipitation that it caused, glacial expansion in the polar regions, resulting in ice age. But again, I have a problem with God saving an animal just to not. One of the same arguments is against the fact that the ark would be on the top of Mount Ararat. Just doesn't seem like the logical place that you would try to release several hundreds of animals is on the top of a glaciated mountain, you know. So I think God's hand was on that ark, you know, till the very end. And I don't know. I one of the most relentless agents of extinction that there is man. And we've caused the extinction of every animal in recorded history that has gone extinct. I mean, I can't think of one that has gone extinct other than at the direct hand of man. Now, we do it indirectly or directly. You know, we kill off animals right and left, either through habitat encroachments and, you know, subsequent run-ins. You know, we get a little too close to them, like all the bears coming up. Pretty soon, we're just going to be a big bear hunt going out, right? I mean, am I right? Yeah, sure.
One more on that timeline. I don't know if you can find it and pull it up again, but you talked about Adam and how long he lived in the generations. There's you know, some of the traits. I think one in the Old Testament, one in the New Testament. There's sons missing. You know, so I find this kind of interesting. I just thought it was mainly for bloodline purposes, and you know, you can, and the Jews really depended on that for like their like Jesus, you know, being in the bloodline of Jews and so forth like that.
It is repeated elsewhere, and there does seem to be some degree of reliability in this specific chronology. But I know what you're talking about. There is like one missing, in one place where it's repeated in the New Testament, there's one missing. And can anyone speak to this with any greater accuracy than I can? I mean, I think we can rely upon it as being a fairly reliable chronological record. Yeah. Whether or not, maybe off by a few years, but I doubt that we'd be off by an order of magnitude, 6 billion instead of 6,000. I don't think we're going to be off by that far.
Yeah.
This guy's going to be really old. His date was a little accurate, though. A little accurate. He was on like October 23rd at like noon or something. Yeah. Nailed a little too close.
That wasn't Usher.
Huh?
That was not Usher.
Was it not?
That was Lightfoot, somebody after him.
Oh, really?
And they did that based on a good reason. Not on what the Jews would do, the Jewish calendar.
Mm.
So they had a reason for it. It wasn't like it was.
Oh. Yes, sir.
Usher used not only biblical chronology, but he went into the history of other nations in the area and was able to fill in the gaps.
Hmm. His book is
Annals of the World.
Annals of the World. I was drawing a blank there. Thanks, Bruce. Yeah, Annals of the World. It was recently published by Master Books, and you can now get it for like $65 or something. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we carry it. I have a couple. Yeah, sure. All right. Any others? Yeah, Dr. J. I think it's a lot of times also overlooked just how many reptiles alive today may themselves be a distant ancestor of one of these really big varieties that lived back in before the flood. I mean, when we look at animals today, you know, they go from really, really small to really, really big. You know, if you look at even the dog breeding itself between the Chihuahua and the Great Dane, right? If those animals lived out in nature, we wouldn't even know they were related. And so you have to, if all animals theoretically possess this same kind of ability to vary in size and to some degree shape and colors and everything else, just how many of the reptiles that are alive today are actually ancestors of those really big varieties? It would be very much to their advantage today to be little bitty, because we kill a reptile's about as threatening as they get. You know, we are more afraid of reptiles than we are any other animal. And if a reptile gets larger than a small dog today, we're going to kill it. You know, so it'd be very much their advantage to be small. So it all goes to some degree standard, which we would call biological evolution, natural selection versus inherent variability. And if these dinosaurs had that inherent variability to be small or large, and there was strong selective pressure for them to be really small, then they're going to be really small today. I've often pointed to many animals that have a similar type in the fossil record, like the horned toad. You know what the horned toad is? There's one of those that's in the fossil record. Its name escapes me, though, a really huge variety of that. I point to others that are not necessarily all. The rhinoceros, to me, Triceratops looks like a rhinoceros to me. But to my knowledge, the Triceratops laid eggs, did they not? So, but then again, I'm not sure that's significant either. Duck-billed platypus is a mammal that lays an egg. Just exactly how many animals are able to make a change there either from placental to egg laying, right? I'm not sure we can put a limit there either. But just some of these small reptiles versus the really big ones, you know, they still could be related. Anyway, I think we're getting way off topic. Any other questions or comments? No, I'll go ahead. And, yes, sir. I mean, most creationists, from the creation story itself, it talks like God created the earth and then created the stars also. It referred to this very, very much after the fact. God created the earth, created the sun, the moon, and the stars also. Very matter-of-factly, the rest of it was created also, but as if the purpose of the entire creation was for the earth itself. So most creationists across the board would just assume that there is no life elsewhere, that the purpose of the cosmos is for the earth itself, and to declare the glory of God, provide these lights for various purposes and things.
But we're getting close to exploring Mars and so on. You think you'd be able to see if there's any life, and if there is no life, what will that say to science?
Well, yeah. I think they recognize that how unlikely it was for there to be life here. You know, even if we were the right distance from the sun, and even if there was water, you know, this is very, very unlikely for life I don't think they'd be surprised.
So much other galaxies, stars, trillions of places like this, how could there not be some other kind of life?
I think they would have to find a trillion planets that are at the exact right spot, just where ours is, and then see that there was not life on any of them, and then say, we'll eventually find it. They would still expect, you know.
Project SETI has been in operation for, 30 years, and they haven't found the slightest trace.
And how many, all of these missions to Mars are basically for that purpose. They now realize that life probably could not have originated on Earth, because oxygen has always been present. And oxygen very much goes against the formations of amino acids and these kind of necessary building blocks. And when they check the rocks that go back to the very beginning of the Earth, they all have oxides in them. So they seem to be relatively convinced now that Earth's atmosphere always had oxygen and life could not have originated here. So now they're saying, well, it must have originated on someplace like Mars, which, by the way, is still amazingly close to being able to support life. It does get into the low 70s. It does have oxygen in the atmosphere, though mostly carbon dioxide. It'd be like breathing someone's exhale from a bag or something. It'd be like you breathing a bag, you know, or something. We find it very difficult to breathe, but it's not all of that far off. This book, Astronomy Book, he mentions how close Mars is to being able to support life and why God would have created it that way. Did he create it that way for us to eventually use it? Or he actually mentions it at questioning that very thing as well. It's hard to say. Yeah.
I guess the position is generally that no other life exists anywhere else.
That's generally the position, no other life. Of course, I grew up in Roswell, New Mexico, and... And so I can't really speak to that. You know, they tend to keep tabs on me.
When you think about it, if evolution ever gets in trouble enough or creation gets widespread enough, that would probably be another good alternative for them, that, you know, here's the aliens and here's where we came from. That'd be the next.
Oh, that's where all the sci-fi movies eventually take. There was one, Mission to Mars. Did you ever see Mission to Mars? They go to Mars. They find a big shape on Mars. When they go inside of it, then there's the whole cosmic evolution is played out right there, and their world experiences some kind of catastrophe, and they send seed, DNA, to Earth. I just can't hardly watch a sci-fi show anymore without eventually getting down to an evolution ideology.
A quick comment on the last question is that astronomers have calculated the habitable zone about the Earth. It's about between 5% farther away from the Earth's orbit, or 5% inside. And that's a very small region from the sun. And the Mars is way outside that, indicating it would have runaway glaciation if it had any water. And inside would be runaway so-called carbon dioxide, a greenhouse effect. The problem with Mars is it cannot have liquid water. There's no liquid water possible on Mars.
Well, I'm not saying that there was a system like we have here, but
right.
We've been on the moon by
right.
Our own means.
Right.
And erstwhile other intelligence could have been on Mars by their own means.
Right, but the point is that nothing can live on Mars.
Not by natural means.
I'm saying it's a semantic importance, because every article I've seen about Mars in the media never bothers to mention that liquid water is
possible. Well, I see. That is the point, though. Yeah, I'm talking about also natural land. Yeah, that's right.
They want to make you convinced that life is possible on Mars. Yeah. They don't want to tell you that water, liquid water is impossible. You know what the triple point of water is that when ice and liquid and vapor all merge. So water will go from solid ice to vapor without going through liquid phase.
Sublimation, yeah. Yeah, that's what they do. They tell you the evidence to support their theory and not tell you about any of the evidence that contradicts it. But that's ultimately what scientists do. They write papers presenting the evidence to support their theory, and why would they show you this, the stuff that goes against it? And ultimately, they're trying to prove their hypothesis or the theory that they've researched. And it's not that they should be criticized for doing so. That's the nature of science.
We have to be both sides of it. I've got one more thing if I can ask.
Sure.
You mentioned in the deal that God created mature fruit and mature animals and man, and then there was two or three others I missed them. I was trying to run down, which made me think about a star and the light beam. If it's 10 million light years away, let's say, then it would take 10 million light years before we could actually see it, and then so they kind of count back in the age.
Now, next month, I'm going to get into more Big Bang cosmology. I'm not going to go into the speed of light controversy to any great depth. I'm more focusing on other aspects, but I will touch on it to some extent. Just there are three general explanations for how distant starlight reached our Earth. One is light in transit theory, which I don't believe is credible at all, because that would basically be stating that God created light to come to this Earth that indicates a supernova or some event that never happened. Do you know what I'm saying? It would, to some extent, be deceitful. And it just seems really weird that that would have happened. Another is variable speed of light, what they call CDK. That light speed has actually been variable. The other is through what they call gravitational time dilation. So the most prominent is Russell Humphrey's model of gravitational time dilation, which is a little complex, but it basically says that with the Earth at the center of the universe, it was in a gravitational well, and gravity affects time. And so based on his model, time in the creation week would have been progressing much more slowly on the Earth, center of the universe in this gravitational well, than it would have been happening elsewhere. And that at the end of the creation week, so during the creation week, you had all of these cosmic processes going on, galaxies forming, stars forming, all this kind of stuff. And then in the end of the creation week, or at some point, he stretched out the universe.
So you can but see that's...
Well, space stretched, and the light and that went with it as well. So, but Russell Humphrey's model is—it seems to be the most most well accepted. The theory of what they call gravitational time dilation. Two things affect time, right? Gravity and velocity, right? So they can even check it on Earth. The lower you are on Earth, the slower the time. The higher up on the Earth, the faster the time travels. So they know time is affected by gravity, and it's thought that that was one of the factors that affected this distance side. But I can't go into it to a great extent next week, but Russell Humphrey's book, Starlight and Time, is a good one. It's really short. The first couple of chapters deal with it. The rest of it are technical manuscripts that you can elect to read or not. The video goes into it as well. They've remade that video, Starlight and Time, and it has like a 20-minute basic documentary that goes into his model. And then after that, there are a series of discussions between him and John Baumgartner. So it has like 2 hours worth of footage on it now. And I think it gives you a pretty good grasp at what he's getting at with regard to his gravitational time dilation model. So Starlight Time by Russell Humphreys, I think it'll give you a better handle on what's going on there in that particular field than I will have time to go into next week. Unless I find it, I'm going to try to pull a video clip out of that next, and we'll try to remember that I have to figure out how to get my sound up here working. I don't know how to do that. How are we going to get sound? Yeah, we'll worry about it next week. Let me close this out. Father, thank you so much that we have the opportunity to come and learn more about you, Father, and learn more about your creation and to have a sharing of knowledge and a sharing of minds here, Father. We can learn so much from each other. We thank you that we have the opportunity that we live in a country where we're free to come and worship, where we're free to express our belief in you, Father. And we just ask that you help us be better witnesses for you, Father, that you give us the time to study, give us someone to witness to, Father. Allow us to serve you. In Christ's name, amen.